is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you on the Monday after the Christmas holidays and the first day of the New Year's week, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. When is New Year's? Thursday? Yeah. Okay. There you go. I don't do calendars, right? I don't do time. It's amazing what's in the news and what and some topics that I think are really worth discussing today. Neil McCabe is going to drop by in our second hour. We're gonna debate drug testing and welfare and things. But other than that, today, tomorrow, Wednesday, this week, we'll make it anything goes holiday if there's something that you want to talk about. I've got a bunch of different topics. I just want to share with you some of the things that really caught my attention in the news and that I think are worthy of yours as well. And I want to get into economics. I want to get into tax policy, what the Republicans have planned. And I want to talk about race. So start out with race. An interesting piece. It's a repost of a Salon piece over at Salon.com. Babylon Sister reposted a piece of it over at Democratic Underground with this headline, which I'm assuming is Babylon Sister's headline rather than the headline from Salon. Rudy Giuliani crosses line on race. Why Republicans must finally push back on his recklessness. Okay, and you know they Elias Isquith wrote the piece for Salon. And I'm not sure if this is the commentary or from the piece, but blaming the murder of two NYPD officers on President Obama isn't just stupid. It's delegitimizing and obscene. You recall Rudy Giuliani went on national television after these two police officers were shot by a mentally ill black man in New York City and who had just shot his girlfriend. Didn't kill her, but he killed the two police officers. Giuliani went on national television and said that the president had begun this process of basically calling for violence against the police and that the mayor was continuing it. Here's the exact quote. Giuliani said, "We've had 4 months of propaganda, starting with the president, that everyone should hate the police." This was on Fox News Sunday morning a week ago. The protests are being embraced. The protests are being encouraged. Even the peaceful protests, he said, lead to a conclusion. The police are bad. The police are racist. And then this is the commentary in the piece. We should be shaken and concerned by the complete lack of pushback from other elite Republicans to Giuliani. I mean, where are the Republicans saying, former Mayor Giuliani, you've gone off the rails. The president never said hate the police. Bill de Blasio never said hate the police. I mean, this is wild, bigoted, bizarre stuff. And zero, to the best of my knowledge. I mean, maybe you know of one that I don't know of. But no Republicans have come out and said, Giuliani, you crossed the line. And he certainly wasn't censured by Fox News for this, or criticized by Fox News for it. Kelly Goff has an interesting piece. So there's three stories here I want to share with you about race and then move on to other things. And you know, if you have thoughts on these things, call in. You know, we'll talk about it. Kelly Goff, who's been on our program a couple of times over the years, a thoughtful young woman, African-American woman. She says, Obama is right on race. The media is wrong. And she points out, you know, the president recently said, quote, I actually think it's probably, and he's talking about America. He said, I actually think it's probably in its day-to-day interactions less racially divided than when he took office. In other words, President Obama is saying in the 6 years that he's been president, the country has become less racially divided. The right-wing media went nuts when he said this. How can you say that? Look at all those black people protesting in Ferguson and black people protesting in New York City and a black guy killing two cops in New York. Obviously, you know, there's a huge racial divide in this country and it's getting worse and worse and worse. Well, no, says Kelly Goff. And I agree with her. I mean, the fact that people are protesting and it has broken through into the largely white controlled mainstream media, the corporate media in America, I think is a sign that the people are coming together on race in the United States rather than fracturing, number one. And number two, then Kelly Goff lays out a couple statistics of which I was unaware, but makes absolute sense. She says the number of interracial married couples reached an all-time high in 2012, the last year that we have statistics for. This was 3 years after President Obama took office. Jumping from 7% in 2000, when George W. Bush won the election or was given the election by the Supreme Court, 7% of marriages were interracial. 18% in 2012. That's more than doubling. And I'll, you know, as a person who has a person in my direct family, larger family, the husband of one of my cousins, who is not a white male, in quotes. I think she's absolutely right. You know, families who have been racially homogenous for years now are becoming heterogeneous, if I'm using those words right, or do I have it backwards? I always mix those two words up. I think, you know, Shane thinks I'm right. Anyway, that's... Well, this is how she says it. A large number of Americans are now either related to someone or know someone who is in one or has been in a interracial relationship. Furthermore, mixed race children are the fastest growing population in the country. And she says this is going to spark an evolution of sort. And I think this is the same thing with the whole gay marriage thing. It's like sometime in the last 10 years or so, and there's probably somebody who's a real authority on this who could pinpoint it. Gay people, high-profile gay people included, like in the media, started coming out. And in families, gay people started coming out. And suddenly, everybody discovered they've got a gay person somewhere in their family. And so, you know, we went from literally being gay being a felony in the United States 30 and 40 years ago, maybe even 20 years ago, and some parts of the South, it may even be that way today, to the vast majority of Americans supporting gay marriage. Well, she says in 1958, only 4% of Americans supported interracial couples. 1958, 4%. By 2012, it's 87%. We've flipped on this. Okay, it's a good thing. And then just along these lines, but there's one group that really doesn't seem to have caught up with the rest of us, and that's the police, it seems. A woman drives through suburban Chattanooga neighborhood clad in body armor. Reading this from Talking Points memo, piece by Josh Marshall. Hand out the driver's side window, shooting at cars and people. She pointed her firearm at the police, but was taken into custody without injury. She was white. Two guys show up at a Walmart, pick up the BB guns, load them, and start shooting people. Police come. They're in custody. They're not dead. White guys. So that's my start. Now, from there, I want to get into Sir James Dyson owns more land in England than the Queen. Is it really? Do we really want to maintain these, I call them monopolies, patents and copyrights? And then Chuck Todd accidentally told the truth on Meet the Press. This is astonishing.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
In fact, I think, you know, I started out with the race, but I think probably the biggest story of the year is that Chuck Todd told the truth by accident. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And hang on just a second while I clean up my desktop here, and we'll pick up your phone calls. Lawrence watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, Lawrence, what's up?
Hey, Tom, love your show.
Thank you.
This race business is really confusing. And I say that because, well, I was born in 1958. So I was one of the first black children bused to an all-white school and da-da-da-da-da.
Wow.
And yet we've come a long way in a lot of areas, except the institutional racism, you know. And there's been a lot of misinformation given out to both sides. Unfortunately, it's hard for a lot of white people to believe the extent, that racism permeates the black communities in particular. But it's hard for them to really believe that this country that we all love still exists on this idea of a permanent underclass. It right. just does.
Right.
And you take gun rights, for example, as long as, blacks are killing blacks and they love to tell that story, everything's okay. But as soon as, it starts hitting the white community, things are starting to be talked about, things are starting to, actions are being taken. And so, my real comment is that I hope that people continue – progressive people continue to do other than what we're told, because we're told so many lies in a God-given day. It's really sad. And so I just love your show, and I just wanted to give you that comment.
Okay. Well said, Lawrence. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for sharing your story with us. Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny.
Good morning, Tom, and a happy next holiday to you.
Yeah, there you go. Happy New Year.
I was really outraged and kind of scared when I looked at that video of all those New York City policemen in dress uniform with their backs turned to their commander-in-chief, Mayor de Blasio, who never, like you said, he never said anything remotely close to what Patrick Lynch, the Police Benevolent Association spokesperson or president, said. And by the way, Patrick Lynch, that's an appropriate last name for him. He
Yikes.
Looks like he's so hate-filled. A middle-aged white male. He's the wrong person who speaks for police officers. And you look at all those policemen, you could tell they're all baldy, bald-headed, or crew-cut-wearing guys. They need to start growing their hair long. We need some hippies in the police. Bring back some Serpicos, for Christ's sake. I've got two ideas for T-shirts.
Yeah, you saw Frank Serpico, who wrote an op-ed last week, basically calling the New York cops wusses? Saying, get over it.
Not so much wusses, but they're all brainwashed to actually believe they're Patrick Lynch guy to all turn around.
They've got an entire media infrastructure that is telling them this stuff. You got Fox News and all the right wing talk show hosts that are constantly telling them that they're that liberals hate them or Democrats hate them or black people hate them or whatever. And really, we just want our police to, protect and serve us, right? Johnny, well said. Thanks a lot for the call. It's just, it's astonishing. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. By the way, another possible topic, if you would like, is, what did you do and what did you learn from what you did over the holiday season, over the Hanukkah, Christmas, whatever it may be for you, over this last, principally last week. Louise and I flew out to Portland on Christmas Eve. First time in my life, I'm a pilot. Right. Not a commercial pilot, but a private pilot. But I know what a pitot tube is. Pitot tube is that little thing on the front of the airplane about the size of a hot dog that air flows through it and measures the speed of the air. Or actually it measures the pressure of the air against it, but it extrapolates speed from that. It's your airspeed indicator, right, for the airplane. And I'm watching them repair the plane. We were on the ground 5 hours waiting for our plane to be fixed. And I'm watching the guy repair the pitot tube. He's trying to take the entire pitot tube assembly out. And first he gets three of the screws out. The fourth screw he can't get out. He's like really working on it with a screwdriver. And then he pulls out an electric screwdriver and he's doing it and he's leaning against it. And I'm like, oh my God, he's stripped the screw. Then he gets out an electric drill. He drills out the screw. Then he puts a tap in there and he's rethreading the hole. Then he goes through his toolbox, and he can't find a screw that fits the new hole. So he pulls out a roll of duct tape and puts it over the hole. About a 2-inch square piece of duct tape. And I'm watching this going, I wonder what that's going to do to the flow of air around the pitot tube. What if it comes off? Is this a hole that's through the structural part of the air? You know, it's just, and then they bored us. But anyhow, that was just a weird story. But we went to Portland, and on Christmas Day, what we did, and this was, I take no credit for this. It was our youngest daughter's suggestion, as I recall, was the entire family, 12 of us, me, Louise, our three kids, two of their significant others, my mother-in-law, who is 84, my brother-in-law, who's my age, and his wife. We all volunteered to serve food to homeless people at a place in Portland, at a big Portland charity. And, you know, so we spent 3 hours bringing food to people. I mean, you know, they were all there in the room. I've played waiter, coming by people's table. You know, can I get you some more? Would you like a piece of pumpkin pie? Would you like some coffee? And it was wonderful. And you know, if I wasn't on the radio, I wouldn't talk about it. I'm really of the, you know, the Matthew 6 or Matthew 7 philosophy that if you talk about your good deeds, they don't count. But I am talking about this because I want to encourage you to do something like this. It was an extraordinary and meaningful day for our entire family. It was just wonderful. So anyhow, I mentioned that. Oh, and of course, we stayed with our son who lives in Washington State. So apparently, I'm less likely to get Alzheimer's now. This in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease, this research just published. I say that because Louise and I smoked some pot while we were there to get to sleep. We only do it at night to get to sleep, but, you know. Anyhow, the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease, quote, strongly suggests that THC could be a potential therapeutic treatment option for Alzheimer's disease through multiple functions and pathways. I'm quoting now from a study that was published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. It was done research done at the University of South Florida and Thomas Jefferson University. And these are verbatim quotes, what they found. THC, the researchers found THC to be effective at lowering alpha beta amyloid. These are the plaques that form in the brains of Alzheimer's people. To be effective at lowering alpha beta amyloid levels in a dose dependent manner. More pot, less Alzheimer's. The main active ingredient in pot directly interacts with amyloid B, thereby inhibiting aggression of the amyloid, of the growth of the plaques. THC was also effective at lowering other key Alzheimer's disease markers. Furthermore, no toxicity was observed. The researchers also found that THC enhances the function of the cell's energy factories, the mitochondria. THC is known, THC is known to be a potent antioxidant with neuroprotective properties, but this is the first report that the compound directly affects Alzheimer's pathology by decreasing amyloid beta levels, inhibiting its aggression, and enhancing mitochondrial function. States study lead author Chenhai Chow. This is from sfgate.com, from the blog over at the Smell the Truth blog, I guess. Alzheimer's disease is thought, now I'm quoting from the article rather than the study. Alzheimer's disease is thought to result from a lifetime of brain inflammation. In fact, now I'm not quoting from anything. I'm just telling you what I've read. There is a fairly substantial body of evidence that sugar might be one of the main things causing brain inflammation throughout the course of our lifetimes. And now that we all eat, you know, 100 pounds of sugar a year or whatever it is, that might be what's accounting for this explosion of Alzheimer's. Anyhow, Alzheimer's disease is thought to result from a lifetime of brain inflammation. Cannabis is one of the most safe anti-inflammatories in all of medicine. Quoting from the article, cannabis slows brain aging, Time magazine reported in 2012. What we found, this is from the study, what we found was that not only did a single puff a day reverse the memory impairment, but also restarted neurogenesis. Neurogenesis is the regrowing of nerve cells. The U.S. government has patented the marijuana molecule CBD as a neuroprotectant. Okay. Finally, here's what de Blasio, the governor or the mayor of New York City, said that the cops... that the Mr. Lynch, the head of the police union, says is calling for hatred of the police. He said, quote, "This is profoundly personal for me. I was at the White House the other day, and the president of the United States turned to me, and he met Dante, that's his son, a few months ago, and he said that Dante reminded him of what he looked like as a teenager. And he said, you know, he said, I know you see this crisis through a very personal lens. I said to him, I did, because Charlene and I, his African-American wife, have talked to Dante, his mixed-race son, for years about the dangers he may face. A good young man, a law-abiding young man, who would never think to do anything wrong, and yet because of a history that still hangs over us, the dangers he may face, we've had to literally train him, as families have all over the city for decades, in how to take special care at any encounter he has with the police officers who are there to protect him." Does that sound to you like hate the cops? But the cops are turning their back on this guy, flying banners on an airplane that says, "We turn our back on you." This is hateful rhetoric on the part of the police and Fox News and right-wing talk radio. It's amazing.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And I have not yet gotten to the most amazing story, which will be the lead for next year, which is dynamic scoring, what the Republicans want to do to raise your taxes. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. You have heard me rail. I will get to your calls in just a moment, I promise. Our board is totally slammed. But I there's just so much stuff here I wanted to share with you before we get into this. Shano just pointed out to me, and I think it is a brilliant observation. If you were in the U.S. military and the president walked by and you turned your back on him, the commander-in-chief, you would be court-martialed. Why is de Blasio not firing every single cop who turned his back on him? I can tell you why these guys are going after de Blasio. He is the Dell and Issaquah pointed it out in our chat room just a few minutes ago. I think it was Dell. He is the most liberal, high profile, overwhelmingly elected politician in America right now. Or certainly one of the top 10. So take him down. Take him down. Destroy him. What's so bizarre is that the police union is leading the charge against a guy who defends unions. But that's a whole other thing. Anyhow, in the meantime, Chuck Todd accidentally told the truth. I have been ranting for years and years about how our media is, how to say it. Let me start back at the beginning. The First Amendment defends the press because the idea of the founders was that the press will be a check on government. If you want government to be responsive to the people, if you want government to be responsible, if you want government to behave itself, then the press exposing misdeeds of government or people in government is the corrective for that, to quote or to paraphrase Jefferson. His corrective was the word he used. But now, since Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act in 82, and Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act in 96, we've got basically a handful of large mega corporations that are really not in the press business that own our press. And they have no commitment to the truth. They have a commitment to making money. And here is Chuck Todd admitting this as he's talking with Lewis Black of the Daily Show on Meet the Press. This was Meet the Press this Sunday. I didn't see the show. I was on an airplane all day yesterday. Two airplanes. No duct tape. And here he is. Just he's basically what here's the thing. You know, first of all, I don't ever recall a Democratic politician refusing to go on a major, you know, ABC, CBS, NBC, ever under any circumstances. But Republicans, I mean, you know, with a single exception, Mitt Romney refused to go on Meet the Press ever, right, in the last 3 years. He went on once in September of, when he was running for president, once. But he's constantly on Fox News. So here's Chuck Todd accidentally telling the truth that they allow Republicans to lie on Meet the Press because he's afraid that if he, quote, barks at them, they won't come back on the show. And if he can't get Republicans to come on the show, he will lose his job. Here he is.
Should you guys be held responsible if people are cynical and think all government's broken? Because that's the other premise of this initial article.
No. That started way before this.
Right.
I really do think part of the problem is that the cynicism is caused by the fact that more in the course of my lifetime and having lived in Washington, that Washington is increasingly in a bubble, much the same way that a lot of people who live in Hollywood are in a bubble. When I started going on the road 25 years ago, and I was told, well, you're too angry, they're not going to get it. What I was discovering was they were angrier than I was. And there's a sense of disenfranchisement now that I think is seen in the number of people who went and voted that I have just never experienced in my lifetime. Right. And I've watched you and everybody else, where somebody comes on, and I don't know how you do it, because I'd be barking at them. Because I'll sit there and go, and you sit
there.
You
know, we all sit there because we all know the first time we bark, the last time we do the show. There's something sometimes, or that's the last time you're ever, all of a sudden, nobody will come on your show, right? There is that balance sometimes.
And the thing that comedy gets
bingo.
To do, that's
you get to do some stuff that we don't.
Right. Bingo. I mean, the first time you bark, it's the last show, right? Nobody will come on your show, Chuck Todd says to Lewis Black, after he's trying to blame The Daily Show for cynicism about the media, right? It's amazing. Absolutely amazing. But it's also a serious problem. We really do need media in this country that talks back to politicians. And we really don't have it, by and large. Other than maybe, I was going to say, other than maybe this show, except that, by and large, Republican politicians won't come on my show anymore. You know, I treat them reasonably well, but I do challenge them. They've all figured out, everybody's figured out, hey, if you're a Republican, you go on Fox News. You're a Democrat, you go on MSNBC, and you won't be asked tough questions. It shouldn't be that way. Anyway, Kathy in Georgetown, Colorado. Hey, Kathy, what's up? Kathy? You are on the – Kathy's listening to her TV, not her phone. We'll come back to you, Kathy, in a minute. Bruce in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Bruce, what's up?
Yeah, appreciate the fact that you're doing your bit to try to get the word out.
Thank you.
I'm actually a retiree leader for the steelworkers, mm-hmm. working with SOAR. One of the things I want to touch on is that, you know, we constantly talk about this question of young African American people being under the gun and being killed by police and harassed. What I think we're not talking about is the institutional nature of racism in the country. You know, there was a great book put out actually by a woman here in Columbus, Ohio, called The New Jim Crow, Melissa Brown. She talked about how the ruling class had slavery and it had to institute Jim Crow to have a control over the working class and African American folks. And then that when that ended by a big multiracial alliance, that the drug wars have been the new control.
Right. Michelle Alexander wrote that book. Yeah.
Right. And, you know, what we're not talking about is that this situation was set up specifically and on purpose. It isn't that black folks or white folks, as you alluded to, go to communities and live by themselves because that's what we want. It just isn't so. But, you know, talking about, you know, in the work I'm doing, Social Security, when it was first set up, actually excluded, you know, they had to get the votes of Dixiecrats, and they actually excluded almost all the trades that African Americans were able to get into.
Right.
And, you know, we had to fight the steelworkers to get, you know, go to court, federal court, to get jobs opened up for African American workers who were automatically put in the hardest, worst, and lowest paid jobs.
Right.
Literally every one of the housing developments, almost everyone in the country, had
covenants,
so-called legal redlining, where black right. folks couldn't get good homes and also could not access credit. The GI Bill excluded African Americans, and so on and so on and so
Actually,
on.
The GI Bill didn't
drug
exclude.
Wars are enforced unequally.
Yeah, so, you're right. The GI Bill didn't specifically exclude African Americans. What happened, though, was that African Americans trying to use GI Bill benefits had to go through banks, and banks redlined. Banks were
right,
excluding African Americans.
Correct. Absolutely correct. And I think I think the question of the institutional nature of racism, you know, focusing on that on a larger scale, forces us to fight for real institutional change, and it's one that, you know, is a unifying rather than divisive factor.
Yes.
As you touched on.
Yes.
And, you know, if we're fighting for institutional change, it's institutional change for the whole work class, especially for those that have not been able to access it. And I think that, you know, kind of helps us deal with this in a different way somewhat. And I think it also, and I'll just say this and hang up and listen, but I think it also places those cops in a little bit different place. Although there are some real jerks that are cops, you know, there are an awful lot of good people too,
yep,
who are put in institutional situations where they are forced to be occupying forces and don't really understand that. And I think dealing with the institutional question is a much more long-range unifying way. So thank you for your work.
You're welcome. Thank you, Bruce. Yeah, and by the way, there's the peer pressure of being thrown in with a group of people who are you know, whatever, whether they're racist or they just watch too much Fox News or they you know, whatever. It's particularly in a paramilitary organization like a police department, I would think it would be very, very, very hard to stand up to that peer pressure. And, you know, you don't want to be ostracized by your fellow workers, particularly in the police business where, you know, your life is on the line. And, you want people to have your back. You don't want to. I'm guessing it's probably very similar in the military. It's got to be a tough one. Bruce, thank you for the call. It's very, very well said. Only got, 30 seconds here until 10 seconds till the break. So, we'll pick up another call in just a second. But this Chuck Todd story coming right out on Meet the Press and saying, if I bark at a politician, that's the end of the show, essentially. Right? What he really means is that's the end of his career. Is astonishing. This should be the headline on the New York Times today, right? It should be the number one headline. Chuck Todd accidentally tells truth about American television media. It won't be, but it should be. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Oh, brilliant. Police in Clarkstown, New York have taken a bunch of guns away from a guy who's going out to kill liberals. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Kathy, you want to try it again in Georgetown, Colorado?
Yes.
Hey, Kathy,
Hi,
what's
Tom.
Up?
What's up is Blasio gave the police department $400 million.
Right.
Since he's been elected, that doesn't get mentioned in the discussion. I think that's very important. He just gave them $400 million. What are they complaining about? So, except that the police union has always fought liberal mayors in New York.
Right.
Thank you. Happy New Year to
okay.
you.
Thank you, Kathy. Thank you very much. You're absolutely right, and it's a really good point. And in my mind, there's two issues, and I don't know which one is the predominant one. De Blasio is a white guy married to a black woman, and that clearly has rankled some folks in the New York City Police Department. He's also an unabashed liberal. He's proud of being a liberal, and that makes people politically crazy, and that causes Fox News and the right-wing hate machine, right-wing hate radio to just go nuts on him, So, anyway, John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that, former Mayor Giuliani, I hope he is not trying to become mayor again. But I think, you know, it's interesting. He can grab headlines, and then he can kiss up to the police department, and he accomplishes a lot of political goals. And I wanted to say, you know, this philosophy of winning is everything, as opposed to, as you just said, Chuck Todd, the spineless journalist who has no moral courage, apparently, to take on, you know, his...
Well, it's not just no moral courage, John. It's not just no moral courage. It's that the whole point of protecting the press in the First Amendment was for the press to be adversarial. And basically, in my lifetime, I've seen the press go from being fairly adversarial to being lapdogs.
Right, right. And, you know, I wish that, like, for instance, a person like Dick Cheney, that there was another way that politicians could, you know, maybe look up to people like, for instance, our former Governor Perpich, who, you know, had a committee for human rights, and the outcome of that committee was the Center for the Victims of Torture. Our governor went to...
You're talking about in Minnesota?
In Minnesota, and it's also in Washington, D.C. They have offices there. They helped 23,000 people survive torture, and, you know, not including people who have been tortured in my own family. I think torture touches so many people in this country, and that is why so many of us are here, because we were escaping, our ancestors were escaping, you know, empires where torture was practiced. And I just wanted to mention a friend of mine, a spiritual mentor, Tatiana Marin, and this is just a typical story, who escaped Nazi aggression, Nazi torture. She was in the siege of Leningrad, and to me, that was torture in a grand manner, because it was in between Stalin and Hitler. First of all, Stalin made Leningrad, you know, vulnerable, and then when, you know, she survived the aggression, you know, being starved out, she was put into a cattle car.
Wow.
And taken, you know, to the southern part of the country.
John, we're out of time. Thank you for the call. We'll be back. 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. As I just mentioned on the way out, I just saw this over at Raw Story. Police in Clarkston, New York, have confiscated a cache of high-powered weapons and body armor from a man who was arrested for posting death threats against many Democratic politicians and every liberal supporter of President Barack Obama. The guy's name is Larry Mulqueen, and he was arrested on charges of making terroristic threats, illegally possessing weapons, and harassment. He says he's going to go out and kill liberals. Do you think the New York police are going to? No, I doubt they'll protest this. The local newspaper reported the police searched his home and found 2 high-powered rifles, 2 bayonets, a sword, a buckle knife, body armor, and ammunition, including 100 rounds of 27 so-called tank buster 50-caliber armor-piercing shells. Wow. He threatened to kill all the members of the Congressional Black Caucus. Plus, Congresswoman Nita Lowry, Governor Andrew Cuomo, Senator Chuck Schumer, Senator Harry Reid, and Nancy Pelosi. Think the guy's been listening to right-wing hate radio? Richard, driving through Texas. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Hey, happy holidays to you, Tom.
Thank you. Back at you, Richard.
I just wanted to make an observation, and then actually I had another question for you, too. But the observation is I've got a friend of mine who's an ex-cop, and he's kind of a contradiction to me, because all of his mindset is like very, very conservative, but he's a middle-aged white guy who's married to an African-American woman with a mixed-race child who will not live anywhere other than a suburb that's like predominantly white. He won't go shop anywhere than at a shopping center or a mall that is in a predominantly white area, because he says that other places where there are people of color are ghetto. And it's
where does this guy live?
Well, he lives up in the high desert area right now in Southern California, up near Hesperia.
Uh-huh.
He used to live in a very exclusive community, right on the edge of San Bernardino County and L.A. County, where he literally had a golf course backed up to his back door.
Yeah, okay, so you've got an idiosyncratic friend, I guess, you know, who's a little weird. What's the point, Richard?
Nice guy, though. I mean, he's a great guy, But
Richard, I had a conversation with the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, who seemed like a very nice guy. I mean, that doesn't mean that he doesn't, you know, being a nice guy and espousing hateful rhetoric or behaving in ways that are, you know, Hitler loved dogs. You know, it's like being a nice guy.
I guess the point I'm making is because of his ties to the police department.
Oh, I see. So you think that even though he's living a life that would cause him to be more tolerant, that he's intolerant because he's an ex-cop? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Every time we discuss like one of these shootings where there's a cop involved and with an unarmed citizen, he's 100% of the time always on the side of the police.
Yeah.
Without thinking about what happened or anything. Obviously, whoever it was must have done something to deserve to be shot.
Right. Yeah. Well, there's a certain tribal mentality there, and I think that, you know, is Pat Lynch, the head of the New York Union, the police union, the Patrolman's Benevolent Association. I think he's feeding that. I think he's feeding that kind of tribalism. Richard, thank you for the call. Interesting one. Mark in New York City. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Tom. Hope this year coming in ends up being a better year than next year, you know, because Obama is somewhat of a counterpuncher.
We'll see. He says he's going to pull out his veto pen. I suspect he's going to do it.
Well, I hope. It's, you know, he's actually doing stuff now that he ought to have done 8 years ago, you know.
Yeah.
But back to the thing with the New York City Police Union. One point that hasn't been brought up, which I think everyone should pay attention to, is that the cops are up for a contract. They haven't had, they've been working without a contract, I think, for about 6 years now.
In New York City?
Yes.
Oh, interesting.
And I think a lot of this bombast and rhetoric from Lynch is to set the table for when they do the contract negotiations, that de Blasio can show his love by giving them a huge raise.
That's interesting. If that's all true, it wouldn't surprise me at all. That's a really interesting one. Mark, thank you for the call.
Yeah,
thanks a lot. Lee in Chicago. Hey, Lee, thanks for listening to WCPT. You wanted to talk about Chuck Todd?
Well, I think that Tim Russert would be rolling over in his grave. I mean, Tim was feared by both red or blue. You know, everybody knew that when you went on Face the Nation that he knew more about you than you knew about yourself.
Yeah, or Meet the Press.
And,
I'm with you.
Yeah.
This is, I think that there, what this illustrates is this little quote from a New York Times article that is quoting from Elizabeth Warren's 2009 book, okay? And here's the, it's just three sentences. I'll read it to you. She says, Larry, this is when she first got into politics. Larry Summers, and you know who Larry Summers was, you know, advisor to Obama and Clinton and whatnot, former head of Harvard, I believe it was. Larry Summers leaned back in his chair and offered me some advice. He teed it up this way. I had a choice. I could be an insider or I could be an outsider. Outsiders can say whatever they want, but people on the inside don't listen to them. Insiders, however, get lots of access and a chance to push their ideas. Powerful people listen to what they have to say. But insiders also understand one unbreakable rule. They don't criticize other insiders. And I think that's another dimension of what Chuck Todd
said. I'd like you to consider doing, though. I'd like you to get into negotiations with Bill Moyers and see what can be done to keep what he's been going. You know, he announced his next show is his last show.
Yeah. Well, that's up to Bill and his wife. I mean, that's, I think he's, I can't speak for Bill. I don't know, but losing Bill Moyers is a huge national loss. Lee, thank you for the call. Great to hear from you. We will be back. Neil McCabe is going to drop by. We'll have an interesting discussion about drug testing welfare users. I think it's going to be a large meta for a much larger discussion. And then we'll be back with your calls on Anything Goes Holiday here on the Tom Hartman Program. We are live. It is Monday. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters: Identity Guard, Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. This plane is apparently at the bottom of the sea. This is another airline aviation tragedy. They haven't found it. Just an FYI, just an update. This Air Asia plane, it's a discounted airline out of Malaysia, which is, this is what, things happening in threes? This would be the third Malaysian plane? I don't know. It's a very, very sad thing. Neil McCabe is on the line with us, apropos not of that, but other things. He's the editor of the Guns and Patriots newsletter and a reporter with Human Events. Gunsandpatriots.com is the website. Neil, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Merry Christmas, Tom. Great to be with you again.
Well, thank you, Neil. Christmas is over.
No, Christmas begins on Christmas Day and continues for 12 days in our church.
Oh, really? Are you Catholic?
Yes.
I didn't know
that.
Not
the best, but I try. I try.
No, I the 12 days of Christmas, I remember this. I didn't grow up Catholic, so I don't know about this. There literally are 12 days of Christmas then, huh?
Right. In a lot of cultures, actually, the big day is the 12th day. And that's why Shakespeare's play, The Twelfth Night, is considered the most magical of nights. It's when the it's when we mark the arrival of the three kings.
So that's 12 days before the 25th, not 12 days after.
No, leading up to after the 25th, because before the 25th is Advent.
Oh, that's right. They showed up to bring gifts to the child, not to predict the child. You got it. Okay. All right. Thank you, Neil.
Sure. So you can say Merry Christmas for another few days.
Yeah. And, okay. Well, Merry Christmas at you.
And on our street, we would always watch to see what families got rid of their Christmas tree before the 12th night. That was
because you knew they were Protestants. You knew they were heretics.
Exactly. We're always on watch for heretics, Tom.
There you go. Okay. Meanwhile, the thing that you and I we had booked for this conversation is last year Utah Republicans passed and enacted a law mandating drug testing for welfare recipients. I'm wondering. I mean, first of all, let me just say very simply, we've tried this and it doesn't work. Or it does work, arguably, but it doesn't produce the results that Republicans want. From 2011 to 2012, just 108 of the 4,086 people who took a drug test in the state of Florida, which mandated it for a year, only 2.6% failed, compared to a national drug use rate of 8%, and it cost the Florida taxpayers $45,000. In Arizona, after 3 years and 87,000 screenings, only one person failed the drug test. But seriously, if we're going to drug test welfare recipients, Walmart got $2.6 billion in welfare payments last year. Should we start drug testing the Walton family?
Or maybe the board of directors of Citibank. They're certainly on a bunch of corporate welfare. I think that there are a lot of things that we could do better. But one of the things that we are going to try to do well is the pilot program in Michigan. We're in three counties. They're going to test it out for a year. If you pop for drugs and you're on welfare, you get your benefits are suspended for 6 months and you're referred to a treatment program. I think that's reasonable, Tom.
The benefits being suspended for 6 months means that a lot of these people are going to end up homeless. That sounds not only unreasonable, but brutal.
Well, we don't know that they'll end up homeless.
Come on, Neil. They are at the highest risk of ending up homeless of pretty much anybody in America because they are poor enough that they qualify for welfare benefits?
Well, I think there's going to be enough notice, Tom, so that people, if they decide that they want their benefits suspended for 6 months, they will pop a drug test.
Okay, let me put this in a different frame, Neil.
I got drug tested a lot. I was on active duty in the Coast Guard, and I'm in the Army Reserve now. I mean, people, they're drug tests. It happens all the time. People accept it. And then there are people who think that drugs are more important than everything else, and they get thrown out of the military.
Right. I understand that. And I'm not sure that I would want somebody, if I was in the military, and particularly in a combat position, I wouldn't want the guy sitting next to me to be, you know, high.
Sure.
Just like you and I probably don't want truck drivers going down the highways high, or anybody for that matter. You know, you don't want people intoxicated when they're doing dangerous things. But what's wrong with somebody on welfare getting high?
Well,
what's wrong with anybody getting high?
That's not productive behavior. You're supposed to be turning your life around. Welfare is not a lifestyle.
Who says?
Welfare is the government and the American people, or, you know, people in your community helping you get back on your feet so you can turn your life around.
You're assuming that absolutely everybody wants to be, quote, a productive member of society. I think that history and science demonstrates that somewhere between 1 and 4% of all people are going to end up in the category of what you would probably call terminally lazy or whatever. It's probably a soft form of mental illness where they sitting around watching TV and getting high is their life, and that's what they want to do. And I, you know, that's such a small percentage of Americans that when you consider let me finish my thought here, Neil. When you consider this, the large cohort of people who are on welfare legitimately, people who are the working poor. I mean, the way that the Walmart got their $2.6 billion welfare payment is that virtually all of their employees qualify for some government support. And to say that you're getting government support because you're working your butt off and you're poor is wrong. But B, if somebody is not working at all, I don't mind there being a few outliers. I don't mind supporting a few people in exchange for being able to make sure that the 20, 30, 40% of Americans who are living at or below the poverty line don't have absolutely disastrous lives. And I don't want to punish them with a damn drug test.
Well, it's not a punishment that you don't get free money. And somebody is, you know, somebody, there are people who are lazy, but let's say there are people who aren't lazy. It's just that they have a drug problem. We need to isolate who those people are and get them treatment.
I'm all in favor of offering drug treatment. I'm all in favor of that. But you don't cut somebody's benefits off. You don't cut somebody's benefits off, Neil, and then say, oh, by the way, get down to this drug treatment program. I don't have any benefits. I can't even afford bus fare anymore.
I think, Tom, that the reality is that if somebody has gone to the government to say, I need help, it's, you know, the money that they're given shouldn't be spent on drugs.
Here's the solution that I think.
Right? I mean, come on.
No,
I
have no problem with people taking welfare money and using it.
Robin Williams said that cocaine is God's way of saying you have too much money. Right?
It's a nice bumper sticker, but it's, you know, apropos of this, what if we were to simply say that as the Swiss are going to vote on next year, everybody in the United States gets $20,000 a year, period, no matter what they're doing. Just like, you know, this is how Sarah Palin ran Alaska. Only it was only, I think the year that she was running for vice president, her family got almost $40,000 just in free money. Right. From the state of Alaska, there was oil revenues that everybody gets a guaranteed minimum income. The guaranteed minimum income of every person in the country is $20,000. And then you do away with all the welfare bureaucracy, all the welfare programs. Everybody gets a guaranteed minimum income. What do you think? We got a little less.
Well, I'm dangerously sympathetic to that. And we've talked about sort of the negative income tax as the earned income credit. But really, that's closer to sort of what Daniel Patrick Moynihan was trying to sell Nixon on, you know, 30, 40 years ago. I really believe that the purpose of our welfare state is to create middle class bureaucracy jobs. And so it's like if you just took the money we spend on all these social welfare programs and divided it up by the recipients and then just cut out all of the sort of the hangers-on, the apparatchiks, all the civil servants, the tens of thousands of people who are actually administering these programs. I mean, more money
well,
would
another,
go to the recipients.
Okay, so we're agreeing on a guaranteed minimum income. Another way to do it, by the way, would be to raise the minimum wage, because then all these Walmart workers would not qualify for welfare.
It's a dynamic situation, Tom.
Yes. Okay. Neil McCabe, GunsAndPatriots.com. Thanks, Neil.
Have a dynamic new year.
Thank you. You too. Good talking with you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Drug testing welfare recipient. I don't get it. What do you think? Do you think we should? We shouldn't? I think it's crazy. We'll be back. Welcome back. Harold in Tucson, Arizona, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Harold, you are on the air. What's up?
Yes, I got to say it. Hello from sunny Tucson, Arizona.
I am jealous. Hey, Harold. I just spent a week in Portland where it rained every day.
A little bit.
Pardon?
I want to change the subject a little bit.
Okay, go for it.
I want to talk about Hollywood's utter hypocrisy. I personally know about it. Do you remember a Hollywood movie a few years ago called The Rose, starring her first movie, Bette Midler?
Yeah. I never saw the movie, but I remember when it came out.
Okay, that was her second starring movie. Her first starring movie she made in Detroit, Michigan, a comedy movie. Hired a comedian to make a comedy movie.
Mm-hmm.
When the movie was announced, Hollywood went ballistic. They did everything imaginable to stop this movie.
Why?
Probably because it would cut in on their profits.
Oh, she was making it independently, you mean?
Well, she...
I mean, how do you get distribution without one of the big studios doing the distribution? How do you get in theaters?
Well, they banned it.
They banned it, wow.
From any theater in the world.
Yeah.
One theater, only one, there in Detroit, Michigan, showed the movie. And even they tried to stop it at the last moment with a court injunction.
Right.
Didn't work. Showed the movie anyway.
Right.
Was it a great movie? No. It was a light comedy. It was enjoyable.
Yeah.
We had a lot of laughs.
Yeah. So, are you bringing this up, Harold, apropos of Sony and North Korea and all that?
Yeah, what hypocrisy. They're crying crocodile tears over, oh, we can't show this movie.
Right.
You know, Hollywood had everything in its power to destroy this other movie.
Oh, I see.
That
was I can't speak to the Bette Midler movie, but I find it interesting that the owner of a 47% owner, largest shareholder apparently of one of the big five chains of movie theaters, who is a outspoken right wing conservative, constantly condemning people for not being tough on terrorists and for not standing up to dictators and tyrants. Was one of the very first guys to say, oh, if Kim Jong-un says that he's going to bomb our theater, we're not going to show the movie. I mean, it was just,
Yeah.
But it was the theater owners who killed it, not Hollywood, Harold.
Yeah. Hollywood used their power to ban this movie. No movie theater in the world dared show it except one.
Bette Midler's movie.
They packed him in.
Oh, you're talking Bette Midler, or you're talking the interview.
First starring movie.
Yeah.
Made there in Detroit.
Yeah. All righty. Well, very interesting. Harold, thank you for sharing the story with us. I appreciate it. And I personally, it wasn't Sony who said, no, we're not going to put the movie out. I mean, ultimately they said that they weren't, and then they did, and it went into a couple hundred theaters. And, apparently people went to see it and nobody got nuked. So much for North Korea. But anyway, we'll be back. It's 20 minutes past me. Kathy in Madison, Wisconsin, listening to the mic. Hey, Kathy, what's up?
Yes, I just wanted to answer your question, Tom. Could you ask what we thought about drug testing, drug testing for welfare? And I feel that if we do, we should drug test all welfare, which would include corporate welfare, and especially oil, because there's no reason why oil should still be getting money from the American taxpayer.
Yeah.
So,
it really
drug test everybody.
Yeah, that's the drug test everybody, because there's really pretty much nobody in the United States who's not getting some kind of welfare, even especially the billionaires. I mean, obviously they're getting an enormous amounts of welfare, but really what this is not a it's really a war on poor people.
Exactly. And now we need a war on people who are collecting subsidies that they don't need.
Right. Yeah, and I think it's just wrong. Kathy, thank you for the call. Thanks for listening to 92.1 FM there. John in Sturgis, Michigan, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, John, what's up?
Hi, and thanks for having me. I got a little distracted by listening on the phone. And,
all right.
The Amish celebrate Old Christmas on January 6th. And
oh, really?
So that culminates things, but I think they celebrate that harder than any other of the 11 other days.
Huh.
And the other thing that bothers me is when you want to drug test and kick these people off the welfare rolls, you're never thinking about the kids, because
right.
It's the kids I'm worried about. The guy who thinks he has to have drugs of one kind or another, maybe he deserves some punishment, taking away some money, but not his kids.
Right. Good, excellent point, John, and one that I completely overlooked in my debate with Neil, and I should have brought up. What about the children of these people? A lot of folks, in fact, I think something like 40% of all welfare recipients in the United States are children. The number might be higher than that. So, yeah, your excellent point. Excellent point. John, thank you for the call. And Robert in Ironwood, Michigan. Hey, Robert, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom.
Hey.
Heretically speaking, I'd like to wish everyone happy holidays.
Thank you. Happy Festivus. And everything else. Happy.
I have a couple non-fictitious anecdotes for you.
Okay.
Number one, I'd like to congratulate Free Speech TV and Tom Hartman and Amy Goodman for passing Fox so-called news in the ratings on Dish Network.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Fox News is not.
Oh, that's because Fox News has been taken off Dish Network. Okay.
Well, congratulations.
It's a semi-pyrrhic victory, but yeah, okay.
The other one is I'd like your thoughts on possibly the most prophetic man of recent times. Rodney King said, can't we all just get along?
Well, and what Kelly Goff is pointing out is that increasingly we are all getting along. And I think this is,
But I mean, the point that Rodney said it after he was beaten shows where we all should have our hearts.
Yes. Yeah, I think Rodney King said the right thing. But these statistics are just astonishing. Just in the last, in the 12 years, from 2000 to 2012, interracial marriages went from 7% to 18% of all weddings. And the fastest growing population of children in the United States are mixed race kids. In 1958, 4% of Americans approved of such couples. I'm quoting Kelly Goff here. By 1997, half of Americans approved, and by 2012, the number was 87%. I think what's happening is people are waking up to the fact that other people are just other people, whether they're gay, whether they're people of color, whether they're, you know, whatever. We're becoming a more tolerant society, and I think that that's a good thing, a more diverse society. Robert.
I think that makes me think of one more thing.
Mm.
Data doesn't lie, Republicans do.
Data doesn't lie, Republicans do. Good paraphrase of Abraham Lincoln. Thank you, Robert. Chris, Lincoln, I'm pretty sure it was Lincoln, who said figures don't lie, but liars can figure. Chris in Bridgewater, New Jersey. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Professor, how are you doing today, sir?
I am well, thank you, Chris. How are you?
Very well, thank you. I just completely agree with everything that you're saying as far as the whole debate with Neil and the drug testing of welfare recipients. It's pretty absurd, you know, this argument that because we're giving public money to somebody, so therefore we should check to see if they're not on drugs is ridiculous, and it's an extension of the whole welfare queen you know, painting of the picture from, you know, back in the 80s. And, you know, all you have to say is like, okay, well, did you like driving on your publicly funded road today? We should drug test you. You know, do you like having clean water come out of the tap? All right, well, we should drug test you too. Do you have an FHA or HUD insured mortgage on your house? All right, you should be getting drug tested too.
Or an insured bank account, which all of them are.
Yeah, actually, FDIC insured bank account, which every single one of us have. You know, it's just more damaging to kind of place public assistance only in the light that, you know, drugs are what you know, holding somebody back from participating in society. Because I mean, how many insanely wealthy people do we know are, you know, use cocaine, you know, out on Wall Street, or even are addicted to prescription meds and the whole opiates and morphine coming out of there. You know, it's detracting from the greater problem, I think.
Yeah. Well said. I agree. I think it's Chris. Thank you for the call. I think what we're looking at is very simple and very easily described, and that is a conservative war on poor people. And it's a war on poor people, and there's a moral and religious element to this, in as much as many conservatives, I'm not speaking about Neil here, or for Neil, or whatever, but many conservatives actually believe that poor people either choose that or are somehow inferior, and that's wrong.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
We have had literally a war on poor people for thousands and thousands of years. Now, interestingly, tribal societies don't have poor people. Eight minutes before the hour, talk media for the sane among us. Tom Hartman here with you on this. It's not a terrible day here in Washington, D.C. It's actually kind of warm out. It wasn't as bad as it was a week or so ago. Anyhow, welcome back. Dynamic scoring. I mentioned this in the first hour of the program, and I want to get back to it. Actually, you know, I'll get back to it at the top of the hour. This is what the Republicans are up to next. What they're going to be doing next, I'll tell you all about it in 30 minutes. But right now, let's pick up some of your phone calls. Steve in Chicago. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'd like to talk to you about a couple of things that you just went over, the labor news.
Yeah.
About the economic, basically, pyramid scheme that 147 companies basically control the way our governments work. Our economics work. Kate Hudge from the World Bank just whistleblew and said she's been a council member for 20 years, stating that 147 companies out of 37 million are basically in control of the money flow. But that's also, that controls the environmental flow too. And after watching your movie, Tom, the last hours, I was already fully aware of all the environmental applications, and environmental hazards crisis we have. And that video made my blood boil. You know, it's frightening. And we're not even, like, we need to tackle these issues before we can worry about racism or economic inequality or drug testing. If we don't deal with these issues, these crises now, then all the other things aren't going to matter in 50 years.
Yeah, I don't disagree, Steve. And I would add that the reason why a few hundred companies or a small handful of very, very wealthy people basically control our political process and thus pretty much everything else is because of the Supreme Court. Because in 1976, in the Buckley versus Vallejo decision, the Supreme Court said that spending money on political campaigns or, you know, to lobby or whatever, that is constitutionally protected under the First Amendment. And in Citizens United, they went back to the 1886 Santa Clara County non-decision, the head note by John Chandler Bancroft Davis, and said that corporations are persons. And those twin doctrines have given us corporate control over our country and turned us from a democratic republic into a kleptocracy. The Supreme Court has turned us into a constitutional monarchy with them as the monarchs. And it's going to take some serious work to undo the damage that this court, the Supreme Court, and not just the Roberts Court, that the Supreme Court has been doing to this country for, you know, most of my lifetime. Steve, thanks for the call. Excellent points. Michael in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, Mr. Hartman. You asked about what we talked about on our holidays.
Mm-hmm.
We were celebrating Christmas, and we were watching some old Led Zeppelin videos, and the song Kashmir came on. Am I correct that the area known as Kashmir which is not controlled by either Pakistan or India, is the only piece of land that is not owned by anybody. Could you please explain to us what it is about the area known as Kashmir?
Wow.
Thank you.
Now, this is not Kashmir as in the sweaters. You're talking about K-A-S-M-I-R.
No.
And
the country.
Yeah, and isn't that the area where there's a lot of people living on houseboats? Is that Kashmir?
I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure it's in the Himalayas. It's in the mountains. It's right near India and Pakistan.
Yeah.
They've been fighting it over for decades.
Right.
But nobody has assumed control, and I just don't understand it.
Well, yeah. I have a theory and an idea, but it's so probable that I'm wrong, I'm not going to say it. Michael, I don't know. Maybe somebody who does know what the situation is with Kashmir will call in and share it with us. Or, you know, I'll have a chance to look it up during the break. Michael, thanks for the call. Always nice to hear from you. Rich in Calumet, Michigan. Hey, Rich.
Hey, Tom. Let me give you a little rundown of my story. I grew up in a bunch of homes and institutions. I worked physical labor, and then I was involved in a serious auto accident where my neck was broke.
Ouch.
I put myself through college and decided I was going to try to help kids, because I somehow made it through the system and came out, I wouldn't say unscathed, but functional.
Right.
Now I'm over $92,000 in debt. I'm
as a result disabled. Of your going to college, you mean?
No, I'm done with college.
Oh,
I've already got my degrees.
Yeah.
I have a degree in human services, BA, and I have two associates, one in criminal justice and one in liberal arts. I can't get a job anywhere, so I was last year put on state disability while I fought for a regular disability case. And in the process, they cut me off state disability last year, and they said, because I have a child in my home and I need to be forced into a slave work program where they pay me $75 a month, then it went from there to now I hear I'm allergic to opioids, by the way, that they want to drug test us now in Michigan, and I'm living on about $300 a month child support, which the state takes 52 of it for processing fee, and I have two children, and now they want to drug test me and may cut me off of the few food stamps I get, and I don't know how I'm supposed to live, and I don't understand it.
Right. They want to cut you out. What, are you using medical marijuana?
Yes.
For the pain because you're allergic to opiates?
Yes.
Wow.
And not even that. They don't like to give out opiates anymore anyhow because so many people supposedly are abusing them.
Well, it's not just supposed. The number of people dying from opiate overdoses has been just exploding over the last few decades, in I think in large part because the pharmaceutical industry is pushing them like crazy. And then there's also the illegal opiates because of the war in Afghanistan. Opium poppy crops are just bumper crops for the last decade. Rich, I'm sorry to hear your story. It's the perfect story to illustrate the stupidity of saying that if anybody is on quote, welfare, end quote, that they should be drug tested, and if they fail the drug test, they should be kicked off. It's also a perfect story to point out the stupidity of anti-marijuana laws and a good argument for a guaranteed minimum income, basic.
Yeah, we need to do something. Like I said, I've been fighting for 8 years to get disability.
Amazing.
And one of the reasons why they denied me was because I was on medical marijuana. It was very obvious. The judge tried to claim that I had some kind of a substance abuse issue, even though I have no history of ever having a substance abuse issue.
Right.
And refused me my disability the first time I went to court. And now I am hoping again that maybe I will get it.
Yeah.
And
amazing.
I put my 30 years in. You know, I've paid into the system, and I can't understand why they won't give me what's mine back.
Well, because they, you know, you're in Michigan, and Rick Snyder had to give big tax cuts to the billionaires, to the DeVos family and his other big Republican supporters. And so there's not many crumbs left on the table to fall off for folks like you, Rich.
Oh, God help us all, man.
Yeah, I'm with you. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you, and I wish you the very best. I hope your coming year is better than your last one. Rich, thank you for the call. Chris in Darlington, South Carolina. Hey, Chris, drug testing?
Yeah, the whole take I get on it is this, you know, the governmental version of the same urge that people have when they see a bum on the corner with a sign up saying, you know, help me, I'm homeless, and they say, oh, I'm not going to give him anything. He's just going to spend it on drugs or alcohol.
Right.
I had a preacher years ago, you know, explain to me that we're not going to be judged on what that bum on the corner does with the money we give. We're going to be judged by what's in our heart when we drop something in his begging basket.
You're right. And even judged by ourselves. I mean, it has to do with our own integrity and humanity, not just, you know, I mean, you don't even have to be religious to get that. Yeah, excellent.
If he goes out and rents a room for the night and gets off the street, so be it. If he goes out, gets drunk. I mean, it's on him. It's not on me.
Yeah, I'm with you. This is well, like I said, it's the war on poor people. It's this. Thank you, Chris, for the. It's this Calvinistic idea. You know, this wasn't so much John Calvin's idea, but it became the idea of his followers, and it's why it's associated with Calvinism so aggressively. The headquarters of the Calvinist Church in the United States, by the way, is, I don't know if it's the headquarters, but kind of the epicenter is near Grand Rapids, Michigan, you know, which is conservative USA. And it's this, the Calvinist idea is that people are inherently evil, right? This comes out of our monotheistic religions, all three, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, have this, you know, the Genesis story, right? And that Eve defied God, ate the apple, and therefore she's punished to conceive in pain, have childbirth pain. And everybody born of a woman is evil and in need of redemption, right? So we're all sinners. So then the question becomes, how do we find good people? If everybody's evil, how do you find good people to run things, to run your government? And they tried, hereditary kings, right? They've got to be the good people. Then they tried priests, oh, they've got to be the good people. And Calvin's suggestion, or the suggestion of his followers, was God will tell you. God will tell you who's the good people and who's the bad people. And how do you know? The good people are rich and the bad people are poor, because God organizes all that. And if you think that way, or even think sort of that way, then drug testing poor people makes sense, because, hey, they might be really evil. They might be doing something terrible. I consider this to be a horrible perversion of Christianity and, frankly, every other religion out there. It's just a horrible thing. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Wow, a lot of calls here on drug testing. Fascinating topics. And don't forget, dynamic scoring is coming up. You're going to want to know what this is. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Ron, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Taylorsville, Kentucky. Ron, you are on the air. What's up?
I just wanted to mention, when people talk about welfare, they forget that some of us are retired and have worked our whole lives. I was very educated, but I chose to teach in a private school, which means you're not going to get a lot of bucks time. Thus, when I retired, my Social Security was quite low. I am, thankfully, able to get quite some welfare to help me out. It's still not really enough, but it's more than I expected.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess what I want to say is, they gripe about giving too much welfare here and there. They neglect the older people who have worked their whole lives.
Right.
And if this is the case, they're going to be spending much more money on the drug testing, which could be used for others, not necessarily for the drug testing. But I get a little upset when they totally neglect the senior citizen population when they talk about welfare. It's always the ones, you know, having the kids or they're out on the street doing nothing. So
right.
I just wanted to make a comment. That's all.
Well said, Ron. Thank you very much. A good contribution to the conversation. I appreciate it. Corky in Rochester, New York. Hey, Corky. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's
Hello.
On your mind?
Merry Christmas. Happy New Year.
Thank you. Back at you.
Here's your proof you've been waiting for. It's proof that the Republican Party is nothing more than bottom feeders.
How so?
They go after the bottom of the food chain.
Oh, you're talking about the debate that we had at the beginning of the hour about drug testing welfare recipients?
Yes. Yes. If you want to apply it equally, it should be both at the bottom and the top. How about we drug test the people that come back from their four martini lunch? We'll be voting on bills that affect 200 million of us.
Yeah, if we were drug testing Congress, John Boehner would lose his job really fast if we included alcohol in the drug tests.
I mean, I think this is a constitutional problem.
How
you're
so?
You're treating one group different than you're treating the other group.
Oh, it's unequal protection. It's a violation of the 14th Amendment.
Exactly. Exactly. This is constitutional. They walk around with that little book all day long, pop it out every time a progressive says something. Well, here, Mr. Boehner, here's your constitution, unequal protection.
Right.
You want to go after the food of the poor people, yet you want to let the people in your office come back from lunch and who knows, they could have been smoking crack.
Yeah. Well, at the very least, we know that Boehner is addicted to both alcohol and nicotine.
Yeah. Yeah, yes. And you want to vote on bills that are going to affect my life?
Now, you're starting to make an argument for drug testing, Corky. Do you intend to do that?
For what?
I said you're starting to make an argument for drug testing. Do you intend to do that?
No, I'm saying if you're going to have a program such as drug testing for wealthy recipients,
right,
it should be applied equally across the population.
Right.
If you want subsidies for oil, you got to get drug tested. If you want subsidies for your corporation, you got to be drug tested.
Right. Drug test the Koch brothers. Corky, thanks for the call. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Bob Ney is with us in just a second. Minutes before the hour, welcome back to the place where smart people get their news. Let's check in. Speaking of smart people, let's check in with Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Bob, the author of Sideswiped. Hey, Congressman, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. I was listening to that conversation. I'm sure you all have talked about the fact that 78% of the people would like members of Congress to be drug and alcohol tested in the poll.
Interesting. No, I didn't know that statistic.
Yes. Well, statistically, you'll have, and I hope I remember this right, about 64% of the people favor welfare recipients to submit to random drug testing. Now, that's just a generic question, okay, 64%.
Right.
If you narrow it down a little bit and then you add in some other things, it'll drop lower. But 64% and 78% to 7% want members of Congress to be drug tested.
Amazing.
Including alcohol. So that's the stat.
Yeah.
It came out about the 25th or 6th, right around Christmas time.
Oh, interesting.
I just thought I'd mention that because, and then the other argument to it is very simple, too. If you're going to drug test randomly welfare recipients, how about the boards of the banks who received billions of dollars and have to make decisions that affect people? And what about a company that receives grant money all over the country? That's another argument, too.
Yeah, well, with regard to banksters and some members of Congress, you can't drug test for sociopathy. And so maybe we should include, psychological profiling as well. But, now I'm getting on very, very thin ice here with regard to my own worldview on this stuff. Anyhow, Bob, what's going on in the world?
Well, off of that, we can still stay on to Congress, though, because the Congress is flexing its muscles. It's very interesting to see what's going on. Tom, the Republicans are trying to come, right out of the barrel, of course, pointed a political gun to the president's head right away in January after the State of the Union. And I say that because the Keystone Pipeline is the number one issue that Mitch McConnell, the incoming leader of the Senate, is salivating over, and he wants that sent to the president. And Mark Kirk, along with Senator Ayotte and John McCain and Lindsey Graham, of course, are talking about more increased sanctions on Iran, which I don't know what's left except to sanction the air in Iran. And let's just say this. This is not, as they say, about trying to give the president a hand up. This is a pure attempt to destroy the president on his Iran policy, because the fact remains, after 30-some years, President Obama is the only one that has gotten near actually bringing Iran under control when it comes to the nuclear issue. And this isn't about assisting them, Tom. This is purely and simple about the fact that they can't, on the heels of a Cuba win, which it has been amongst the citizens, they can't tolerate, meaning the Republican neocon side, a win on Iran.
Right. So didn't Bill Clinton work out something with the Iranians where it's they suspended their nuclear program in exchange for something? I forget the details.
Well, the Iran has went through different phases with the United States. President Clinton was offering an intersection, sort of a consulate, into Iran. At one time it was going to happen, and Ahmadinejad came in, so it's been all, back and forth with it. But there was a deal offered to President Bush which would have completely allowed inspectors on the ground. It was brought to the president, actually via our office. I write about it in my book. And Tim Guliman, the ambassador from Switzerland to Tehran, brought the deal. Years ago, we would have had American inspectors physically on the ground, and Iran would have helped to disband Hezbollah as a terrorist group. And this is all was all in writing, denied and later admitted, by the White House that it
right.
did it.
The Bush White House. Yeah.
Bush. This was Bush.
Yeah.
So now, all these years later, the president, nothing has changed with Iran's nuke position, and President Obama is very, very close. There's a June deadline, but probably close in March through Secretary of State Kerry to having some type of deal. So the first thing out of the box, Tom, beyond Keystone, is going to be Iran. That's all you're going to hear from the Republican side. They want to use the Democratic side to derail it also.
Oh, that's so sad. It's craven. I don't know how to describe it beyond that. What else is going on, Bob?
And beyond that, of course, today we've announced that the longest war has ended after 13 years and 2,000-some American casualties, I believe 20-some thousand on the Afghani side. Then it's officially, over with. Of course, the president had committed during his campaign to end it. And so officially it's ended. We'll keep some type of advisory, positions there with soldiers on an advisory basis. The other story, which I don't know if you, I'm sure you've covered today, but it was quite incredible. But we're reporting on talk radio today about the fact of the commissioner of New York, blaming the White House on NBC's Meet the Press. The president and the attorney general at right. the, quote, highest levels for the police officers. The commissioner's kind of, Tom, having his cake and eat it, too. In one sense, he defends the mayor and the police shouldn't turn his back, and then all of a sudden he turns towards the White House as, quote, the problem.
Right. Yeah, I think it's dog whistle racism, but who knows?
Yeah, and I just thought it was quite amazing.
I think this whole thing of these cops turning their back on de Blasio because he had the temerity to point out that he has a mixed-race son who he has had to tell, be nice when you interact with the police, is astonishing. If any member of the military turned their back on the president, they would be court-martialed.
Well, that's true.
Why are these cops not fired?
Well, I don't understand how it got to the point, the head of the police association had, came out with some of the first statements. But when you actually look at what the mayor said, he just had a conversation with his son, which, frankly, I have had that same conversation with my son. And we're white, but I've had that conversation of don't ever you dare run from the police because, the adrenaline moves and I'm afraid what's going to happen. I've had that conversation. And I just guess because he has a biracial son, all of a sudden it's a horrible thing to tell your child.
Apparently. Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, author of Sideswipe. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. Dynamic scoring. Now, I realize, you know, I've mentioned this a couple times in the last couple hours. It's not the best tease, right? I mean, if you want to get people to continue to listen to your program, you say things like, up next, should kittens be run over? Or something, you know, it's something that's provocative or cute or whatever, but dynamic scoring, people are going, what? What's that? I don't know. I don't care. Well, you better care. Dynamic scoring is something that they came up with during the Reagan administration because the Republicans had a problem. They wanted to cut taxes on rich people, and at the same time, their rhetoric was that they wanted to reduce the national budget deficit. All right, so less debt, but less taxes. Now, if you do the math, and it's a fairly straightforward process, if you reduce taxes on rich people, then the consequence of that is that you get less money. It's very, very simple, right? It's pretty straightforward. And country after country, government after government, you know, have demonstrated this for years and years and years. Cut taxes, you cut government revenues. Art Laffer, though, had come along with this thing. He called it the Laffer curve, which is laughable, which suggested that if you cut taxes on rich people, they will take that money that they would have otherwise paid in taxes and invest it into the economy. Now, history shows that that's not actually what happens. What happens is rich people take that money and they buy a new mansion. Well, I guess that's an investment in the economy of some sort, or buy a yacht, or more likely, they put it into the stock market or they put it into a Swiss bank. And it drives up the stock market. It helps out the Swiss banks, but hey. But the net effect of cutting taxes on rich people is you cut government revenue. But they couldn't come out and say that, because if you cut government revenue without cutting spending, you're going to increase the debt or the deficit. You're going to increase both, actually. So they came up with this thing that was, this is part of they never called it trickle-down economics. They called it supply-side economics. And in order to sell supply-side economics to the American people, they had the CBO, they made sure that the Congressional Budget Office was run by Republicans, majority Republicans, and they invented this new phrase called dynamic scoring. And what it means is we're going to cut taxes on rich people to a tune of, say, you know, we're going to reduce government income by $1 trillion a year. But because we're cutting taxes on rich people, that's going to increase the economy. So we shouldn't view this as a drop in government revenues of $1 trillion. We should actually view it as a drop in government revenues of zero. In fact, it'll actually increase government revenues. So instead of saying we're going to cut taxes and thus cut government income, you say we are going to cut taxes and it's going to magically increase government income. Now, dynamic scoring was used for a couple of years back during the Reagan administration to sell Reaganomics, to sell supply-side economics, trickle-down economics, and it didn't work. Ronald Reagan's, you know, they dropped the top tax rate from 74% down to 28%, and it tripled the national debt. Tripled. Ronald Reagan saw the biggest increase in the national debt outside of wartime of any president in the history of the United States with his dynamic scoring. So it was totally discredited. And pretty much the only people around who still remember the phrase dynamic scoring are people who remember the 80s. And Paul Ryan, who wants to bring it back. I share with you, this is from a blog by R. Muse over at PoliticusUSA.com. PoliticusUSA.com. So it's a great progressive blog. And it is titled, Republicans Plan Another Bush Trickle-Down Assault in 2015. Now, George Bush tried to sell this during his presidency, by the way. So it's not altogether archaic. But he writes, as Republicans prepare to take control of Congress in a couple of weeks after eliminating women's reproductive rights, blocking the president's executive action on immigration enforcement, and thwarting normalized relations with Cuba, they plan to revert to Bush-era trickle-down tax policy. In fact, very high atop the GOP's agenda is reforming what they call the, quote, highly unpopular federal tax code, end quote, to better serve the rich and corporation and express their 30-year love affair and devotion to trickle-down economics. Paul Ryan, he says, it is noteworthy that Paul Ryan intends on reinstituting an exclusively Republican CBO, Congressional Budget Office, to approve the Republican trickle-down tax scheme as an economic boon to fool Americans into thinking that after 30 years, trickle-down will finally work this time. The Republicans' favorite scheme is cutting taxes for the rich and simplifying the tax code for everyone else by expanding the tax base. Translation, raise taxes on lower-income Americans. You'll recall Ronald Reagan started taxing Social Security recipients. Remember that? You got to be an old fart to remember that, but look it up. Now, it wasn't, in all fairness, it wasn't just Reagan. Daniel Patrick Moynihan and Alan Greenspan, you know, had a hand in that. But raise taxes on lower-income Americans, including those living in poverty and elderly Americans living off their meager Social Security retirement income. Republicans have also floated eliminating popular deductions for middle-class taxpayers, thus raising their tax liability to fund corporate and rich Americans' tax cuts. Now, in this blog, he doesn't use the word dynamic scoring, but I can tell you, I'm predicting. This is my prediction for 2015, is that within 1 month of this day, everybody in America will have heard the phrase dynamic scoring several times. Now, I might be wrong. We'll see. But I don't think I'm wrong. I think I'm absolutely correct on this. A couple of interesting threads over at Democratic Underground right now. The origins of the U.S. police. This is one that, you know, I've talked about the slave patrols as being the reason for the Second Amendment. And I've shared with you all the details of that Patrick Henry's speech at the Virginia Ratifying Convention, where he said that, you know, if the Constitution is passed without an amendment that protects the right of the states to maintain their slave patrols, then Congress will free the slaves by simply putting them in the military. They have the power to do that in Article 1, Section 8. And thus free the slaves over the objections of the southern states. But this is a book by Victor E. Kepler, Dr. PhD. It's titled A Brief History of Slavery and the Origins of American Policing. And he writes, slave patrols and night watches, which later became modern, and this is posted by Trillo over on DU. Slave patrols and night watches, which later became modern police departments, were both destined to control the behaviors of minorities, or designed, excuse me, to control the behaviors of minorities. For example, New England settlers appointed Indian constables to police Native Americans. The St. Louis police were founded to protect residents from Native Americans in that frontier city, and many southern police departments began as slave patrols. In 1704, the colony of Carolina developed the nation's first slave patrol. Virginia, for example, enacted more than 130 slave statutes between 1689 and 1865. And it just, you know, basically the similarities between the slave patrols and modern American policing are too salient to dismiss or ignore. Hence, the slave patrols should be considered a forerunner of modern American law enforcement. Now, if you consider that frame, and then you get the head of the patrolman's union in New York saying that the president is saying to hate police, which obviously never happened, 2 plus 2 starts to add up.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Right straight to 4.
Yep.
Anyhow, back to your calls on anything goes. Holiday week. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Jesse in Miami, Florida, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Jesse, thanks for watching. What's up?
Hey, hi, Tom. Happy holiday to you and all.
Thank you. You too.
The thing I want to stick on economics.
Okay.
What I can think, since they've been printing money, the Federal Reserve, fiat money they call it, I would just assume that all economic theory is out the window.
Why?
Because anything, you can apply money to any way you want to use it. I always look at money as a state of mind. You look at gold. Ever since from the beginning, it's been something of value, and the more people think of value of it, the more value it is.
No, actually, that's not true, Jesse. If you go back, if you dig into the origin of money, you go back to the very early records of money. In the Sumerians, it was clay tablets. In Caral, which is the oldest known city in the world, it's on the coast of Peru, it was knots on a rope. And Native Americans used wampum. They used beads. And it wasn't that they had intrinsic value. It was that they were basically ledger marks. They were notations in a ledger saying this person has this of value, which came from that person over there. So
this is one good thing you could say about the evolution of capitalism is the evolution of trust in people. We don't got as far as Bitcoin now, but they could crash to Internet anytime they want, so you can't put so much trust in that. But the main thing is that all the economic theories, how they try to calculate the the debt and all of that stuff. Mm. If you could print money, or you could just make value out of nothing.
No, you don't, because as the money supply goes up, if goods and services don't increase at the same rate, the money becomes worth less. You have a devaluation of your currency. Now, we're doing that. We're doing that intentionally. We're reducing the value of our currency to the tune of around 1% to 3% a year.
The context of the Fed printing all that money since the QE1.
No, we've been printing money since 1913. And the reason why we print a little bit more money than there is activity in the economy is because our government has been continuously in debt all that time. And this allows the government to pay off debts with dollars that have less value. So, they...
Was it Cheney that said debt don't mean nothing?
I don't, Yeah, it was, what Cheney said was Ronald Reagan taught us that deficits don't matter. Yeah.
Well, they're right, because they're printing money. And if you could print money, you could print, do it with it whatever you want, right?
Well, yes and no. Here's the problem, Jesse. Let's say you have an economy that grows by 5% in a year. If you're on a gold standard and you can't acquire 5% more gold, the value of your currency has to go up. In other words, you have deflation.
I would consider that 1% thinking. And I think the only way we're going to get out of this jam is if we start thinking like the 99%.
I don't understand.
If you just said just what you said, where did you learn that from? That's basic inside the box economic thinking, right?
You're right. Yeah, it's kind of Econ 101. Yeah.
Yeah. So we got it. That's why I say if you could print money, you could throw all of that stuff out the window.
Uh huh. Okay, Jesse, thank you very much for the call. Good to hear, and happy holidays to you. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. That's past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jeff in Chaparral, New Mexico, listening on 1290 AM. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, good afternoon, Tom. Hi, this is Jeff. And happy holidays.
Thank you. You too.
Yes, this drug testing, we're funding our own oppression with this.
I agree.
Yeah, we fought it in the unions in the 90s, and we lost.
Mm-hmm.
And currently, I am in New Mexico, and it's a medical marijuana state, and I'm in that program, and it works really well. But to stay with the narcotic prescriptions from an accident I didn't cause, I have to submit to those drug tests every month.
Hmm.
And they just started billing from a new company, and the bill came out at $1,200. The insurance paid $430 of it. If that's monthly, multiply that out.
Wow.
There was 40 other people in that office that received those tests at the same time.
So that cost is the cost of the drug test?
Yeah.
I mean, these drug tests cost nothing to do. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I was just saying these drug tests cost absolutely nothing to do. I mean, the reagents, the chemicals, now they're doing them with computers. They're very, very simple. They're very inexpensive. They're very profitable. I think, you know, what we have done as a country over the last 30 years or so is we have – everything is about how to hustle. You know, it's a hustle. Everything is all about how to make some money without actually making things of value. We don't make things of value in this country anymore. We don't make washing machines and televisions and computers and blue jeans and clothes. And we don't make things of value anymore. Instead, it's all, how can I hustle some money out of somebody else? And drug testing, in my opinion, is just another hustle. It's just another way to extract money from people without giving them anything of value. Am I making sense, Jeff?
Yes, it does. And I followed up to see what they were doing, special testing on that to see if I was all right. And or see if they had any negative effects.
Right.
And it's not. It's just to see if I was on other drugs or if I was actually taking the drugs I was using, morphine, if I was selling them.
Yeah.
The Bush administration, they were really pushing those drugs, and now they're pulling them back during the Obama administration.
Right, right. Yeah, there's these fads that come and go in medicine. Jeff, thank you for the call. Fascinating. Wayne in Pompano Beach, Florida. Hey, Wayne, what's up? Wayne? I think your phone is muted, Wayne. Listening on Sirius in Pompano Beach? Okay. Wayne, you'll have to call back. Jim in Lockport, Illinois. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind?
Hey, happy holidays, Tom.
Thank you. Back at you, Jim. What's up?
Yeah, matter of fact, I'd like to thank you for a wonderful year and also allowing us to talk to Bernie on Fridays. It's always great.
Well, thank you. I'm pleased to do it. I mean, we really need to thank Bernie for showing up every week. He's been doing that for 10 years on this program, and people love it. People love him.
And
Bernie has announced that he's going to decide whether or not to run for president in March. And so, you know, let's hope he does.
That's a tough thing because we lost one line in the Senate, and I don't want to lose another, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
You know, it's,
on the other hand, Bernie Sanders is president. It would be the revival of FDR.
Yeah, true, true. Very much, very much. It would be something to see. It's going to be a tough decision for him to make. You know, being that he's in the legislature and he's always fighting for us. And to take that person out of there is a tough thing, man. But,
I don't think he's up for re-election, though, so... But I'd have to look.
Yeah.
In any case, is that what you called about, Jim?
Oh, no. Actually, what I called about is myself, I'm in the process of reading a book, The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination. I'm sure you're familiar with that.
Yeah. Which one? Who wrote that one?
Lamar Waldron.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
And myself, being that you've done some research on this, and it's something that I've always been a big believer that was probably the darkest day in the country's history to lose that president. And
at least in our lifetime.
Yeah. I always thought Bobby would have even been a better president.
I agree.
Where this country could be if those two guys were able to gain a presidency, or at least continue his 4 years, and Bobby right after him would have been a tremendous asset. But
Anyway, I was wondering if anybody has done any ballistic testing. You know, that single bullet theory I've always thought was a joke. And, you know, to do a test with a 6.5 Mannlicher Carcano through a human skull, wrapped in ballistic gel hair, and also a simulate brain tissue, and fire that from the same angle. Why has nobody ever tested this? Because if that one bullet could shatter Conley's ribs and come out pristine, wouldn't that same bullet go through his head and exit his left eye?
I don't know. I am. When Lamar and I were researching the two books that we wrote together and the third book that Lamar wrote himself on the JFK assassination, I was most of the work that I was doing was digging through newspaper archives and interviewing Cuban hitmen and people involved with the mafia. And
As a matter of fact, right next door to me, I have Stateville Prison. I don't know if you've heard of James Files.
I haven't.
James Files actually admitted to taking the headshot at President Kennedy with a fireball, Remington fireball, behind the picket fence on the grassy knoll, and he was actually hired by Charles Nicoletti.
Huh. Yeah.
Something you may want to look into.
Is that in Lamar's book?
No, actually, it was a different thing that I've gotten that on. But myself, as an election judge over here, I was right next door to Stateville Prison, and I asked him about if James Files was still in Stateville, and he said he's not. They moved him, but he's very credible. He is a credible man. As a matter of fact, I think in the 1980s, they actually dug up a Remington 221 round, which is from that fireball.
Right.
Then he left it on the fence, and he bit the shell casing.
Right.
It did have human dentine marks in it. So for a man that knows so much and left a calling card, which was found,
yeah,
why has this never been brought to the American people?
I honestly don't know, Jim. Thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
There are a lot of fascinating stories around the Kennedy assassination. It's difficult to keep track of them. So we'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And so enough for dynamic scoring. This Joan Walsh, writing in Salon magazine. She says, almost every major urban riot of the 1960s, Harlem and Philadelphia in 64, Watts in 65, New York and Detroit in 67, was touched off by police misconduct. When is somebody going to stand up and say that the people who are protesting, quote, protesting the police, end quote, are not protesting against police? They're protesting against bad police. When is a police department or a spokesperson for the police going to say, we're going to weed out the bad apples? I just don't see it happening. Joan writes, crime is down. Arson is almost non-existent. There are no more riots. Most protests against police abuse are peaceful. And then you've got this one exception, Ismael Brinsley, this mentally ill Brooklyn native who shot his ex-girlfriend in Baltimore, then shot Rafael Ramos and Wenjian Liu. And I would submit to you that, along with Chuck Todd accidentally telling the truth, this is big news, actually. What is going on here is that the hard right and hate radio and hate television are doing everything they can to derail a movement. There is this movement. The hashtag typically is Black Lives Matter. A movement to say, and I started the show by pointing out that there was, you know, two white guys went into a Walmart, picked up the BB gun. Remember the fellow, the black guy who walked into a Walmart and picked up a BB gun, and the police ran in and shot him dead? Well, these two white guys not only picked up a BB gun, but loaded it and started shooting people in the store. They were arrested. Not shot. White woman goes on a killing rampage or a wannabe. She's wearing body armor. She's driving down the street with a handgun sticking out the window, shooting at people. She's charged with three attempted homicide. She points it at the police, the gun. She's blonde. She doesn't get shot. Now, obviously, this, you know, anecdotes don't tell the entire story, and these are merely anecdotes, but there is, I believe, a concerted effort to undermine, discredit, and ultimately destroy any effort to regulate our police departments, to hold our police departments accountable for bad behavior. And I think that, you know, the right loves to run around and go, oh, you've got some bad teachers, and the teachers' unions are protecting them. We need to do away with the union. And by the way, let's get rid of some of the teachers. But you never hear them say the same thing about the police union. This tribalism in America is not a healthy thing for our society. Mike in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You know, the Republicans are the masters of projection. So when it comes to this drug testing, and now that I've thought about it, based on the behavior of many of their members, it may be a cry for help, and maybe they should be the ones that should be tested. Mm. But also, I've noticed, you know, by participating the last several years, that it doesn't really matter. Legislators on both sides of the fence, what kind of job allows people to go to lunch and have a few cocktails and then come back and make decisions for millions of people? I actually think there should be blood alcohol testing during the regular business hours when most of these folks have exhibited that they're willing to participate in using alcohol.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you've got a high-functioning alcoholic as the head of the Republicans in the House of Representatives, John Boehner, who's you know,
absolutely
pretty upfront about it. And Bob Ney in his book Sideswiped just tells stories that would curl your hair, and if any prosecutor ever bothered to follow up on them, would land John Boehner in jail. It's just, yeah. A masters of projection, exactly. They're thinking, oh, yeah, this is either this is how I would be. It's either projection or it is there is typically a racist or at least a classist subtext to this that is that's got those people right at the beginning of the sentence. And, you know, yeah, I'm with you, Mike. Thanks a lot for the call. And thanks for listening to the mic. Dane in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Dane, what's up? Dane, you are on the air. Dane, you'll have to call back. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I don't know if this was brought up with your guest, but Michigan actually is. They did pass a law that now there's drug testing for welfare and food stamp recipients. That's going to be going into effect. I think that's kind of funny. It's the same old sort of, it's diminishing returns. I mean, really, when you think about it, how much money is that going to save? It's probably going to cost the money to test people who are not on drugs. And then my question is, if you find somebody who is on drugs, are you not then obligated to offer them help?
Right.
Or just cut them off? I mean,
I
wanted to...
Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, I was just going to get on to what I was going to say about another aspect of the economy, which mm-hmm. shows Republican hypocrisy with some of the economic numbers going up, the stock market and the unemployment numbers coming down. I've heard last week the Republicans and right wingers going, oh, but the employment eligibility index is way up. You know, that's the index that says that there are people who are eligible to work who are not.
Right.
They're saying it's up 33%, so a third of people who could be working are not, which I thought, well, okay, what's the complaint with apparently people who don't need the money not working? The Republicans have a problem with that, I thought maybe a lot of baby boomers who maybe had lost their jobs or from downsizing maybe just decided I've got enough money, I don't need to go back to work, or they can't find it. You know, they just are not looking because it's almost time to retire. But what occurred to me, really, was that when was the employment eligibility index the highest?
I don't know.
Well, it was in the 1950s and 1960s. It was the stay-at-home mom society.
Of course.
When one income, a good, solid union, high-paying union job could support a family.
Right.
I thought that's the society that the Republicans wanted.
Right. Here's the thing, Paul. You know, Obamacare plays into this too, and I thought it was really interesting to see, because you know, I get these guys on the show, these right wingers, they come prepared with their talking points, and they're like, as a direct result of Obamacare, employment participation in the workforce has dropped by X percent, right? And it's actually a true number, and I'm like, great, because what this means is that there were people who were working just to get health insurance. They hated their jobs. They didn't want the job. They didn't need the income, but they needed the health insurance. And they didn't, you know, they weren't wealthy enough to just pay for health insurance out of their savings. And so they had this job. And now that they can get health insurance through Obamacare at a very, very low cost or at no cost, they're saying, hey, I don't need to be working, which opens up a job for an unemployed person who wants to work. Isn't that a good thing?
Exactly. And still, we have an economy where they don't want to raise the minimum wage. You can't have a stay-at-home mom society anymore. So, you know, the fact that the eligibility, employment eligibility index is up now, it simply means that. But I thought it was kind of a hypocritical when I considered that when most moms stayed at home, that was when it was the highest, and that was when, and that peaked out when one income could support a family. That really peaked out in the late 1960s when the minimum wage actually was at its strongest purchasing power. And since the Reagan era, the minimum wage has increased in these 33 years. The minimum wage has increased 57%, while the cost of living has gone up 1,100%. 57% wage increase, 1,100% cost of living increase.
Wow. Wow. Amazing. Well,
a gallon of gasoline in 1968 was 34 cents a gallon on average.
Right. I remember.
Okay, it's down now, but it's been nearly $4. And I compared, okay, let's compare something else. How about a pound of ground beef in 1968 was about 39 cents a pound. I can't find it anywhere for less than $4 a pound, and usually it's $4.49 to $6.49 a pound. So that's, again, 11 times more.
Go ahead.
For food or gasoline, no matter, depending on what you want, you know. So this is the economy they want. They want people, every last rat should be working for less.
Yeah, yeah. It's Calvinism.
It is Calvinism.
It's you know, put those evil people to work. It's, you know, Arbeit macht frei.
That's right. Work will set you free.
That's
you
right.
That was on the gates of Auschwitz.
That's correct. It was the slogan over the front gate of Auschwitz. It said, Arbeit macht frei. Arbeit
right.
is work.
Right.
Macht makes frei, free. Work, we're shall free.
Right.
Paul, it's always great to hear from you. Thank you very much for the call. And Happy New Year to you. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes for you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And that Asian Airlines plane is still missing, still no clue, still no idea. Looks like it was a bad thunderstorm that took it down. Welcome back. Lane in Blairsville, Georgia. Hey, Lane, what's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Hey, Tom. You're a lousy capitalist. Get this. You got somebody, you know, collecting food stamps, him and his wife, where I live, you know, $6,000, $7,000 a year.
Right.
That person is on probation. You drug test them.
How do you get $6,000 a year worth of food stamps when food stamp benefits are typically around a little less than $2-$3 a day?
All right, so... Whatever. So whatever it is.
So it's 360 days in a year. That would be about $900 a year. That's okay. You know, food stamps. Maybe $1,000 a year. You think somebody's getting rich on food stamps?
No, they're not. But you're here's my point. So whatever it is, I knew a couple that state assistance was only about $200 a month, but the guy's on probation. So he wasn't drug tested, but let's say you drug test him, he's on probation, boom, put him right into prison, and now someone can make, where I live, $48,000 a year, housing the guy for a year. That little bit that you were paying is nothing. Now everybody's happy. The food service at the prison is happy. The laundry service, now we're making some money.
Right.
It's a way to have this guy just collecting food stamps or a little welfare. We got to get some big bucks, put him in prison.
Yeah, you're doing Elaine, your riff here is a variation on my riff earlier about how we don't make anything in the United States of value any longer, and so we've got to figure out ways to hustle money out of each other. And putting people in prison, it stimulates the economy to the tune of 30, 40,
That's
50,
right.
60,000, depending on the prison, $1,000 per year per person. And
you waste this on. So this is being sold. Drug test is being sold as a cost savings. It's just efficiency of the market. Let's make a little bit more money here. And then the taxpayers, they're not going to complain. We're happy to pay it.
Right.
Because the streets are safe. And we're getting our cut on that end. And
yeah.
I'm actually aware of this happening, not in the drug testing, in sting operations against people on probation and right into prison, because we got to keep the prisons full.
Right. Well, in some states, the private prisons actually have contracts that require 90% or greater occupancy. And if the state doesn't fill the prison, they still have to pay. I mean, it's bizarre.
But government prisons, they don't want empty beds. Really, you don't build a prison to keep it empty. There's employment there. There's a lot of money there,
yeah.
And you got to justify it to the taxpayers.
Yeah, yeah. We have more people in prison than even North Korea. Although you could argue that all of North Korea is a prison, so that's probably not the best analogy. But we have more people in prison both in absolute numbers and on a per capita basis. Than China, than any other country in the world. China's the most populous nation in the world.
It's poor people. It's poor people. So it's the war against the poor.
Yeah.
As they need more, believe me, they'll jump up. Where I live, I work part-time. I'm a janitor. I work at night. I'm all the time.
Yeah.
So I don't want to cooperate first, but now I'm a little ticked off, and I'm not going to be so cooperative.
Okay. Lane, I got to go. Thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you. Fascinating article. This is Luke Mullins wrote this. It's called How David Gregory Lost His Job, and it's in the Washingtonian magazine. It's really worth, I'm not going to go through the whole thing with you, but it's really worth reading. Donald in Chicago, listening on WCPT. Hey, Donald, what's up?
Yes, hi, Tom. You know what really disturbs me? Don't get me wrong, because I love our president. I think he's the best president I ever had in my lifetime. The thing is when he goes out and makes a comment about, the war has ended in Afghanistan, I mean, that kind of makes me feel like an idiot. When you leave 13,000 troops left over there, that's not ending the war.
Well, yes and no, Donald. I mean, we still have, 50,000 troops stationed in Germany? We got 20,000 or so stationed in Japan. I may be completely wrong in the numbers, but we still have troops in Germany and Japan. Doesn't mean World War II is still going on.
No, but the thing is, it's like another Korea. Do we have to create another base over there?
I think what's going on, Donald, first of all, President Obama is having to deal with the wreckage of the Bush administration. George W. Bush took the poorest country in the world, Afghanistan, the second poorest country in the world, with an annual GDP of only $2 billion a year. That was all the economic activity in the country, and broke that country and spent $1 trillion breaking it. If we had simply given that money to the Afghans, they would be living like Saudis. They'd be very, very wealthy, insanely wealthy. So number one, we broke the country. We've got a failed state. And so we're trying to keep it from turning into Libya, for example, number one. And number two, Afghanistan is sitting on $1 trillion worth of natural resources, at least. Afghanistan has rare earth minerals. They are the logical and appropriate place for a pipeline from Turkmenistan to India. It's the TAPI pipeline. It was proposed back in the 80s, and they've been trying to build that thing forever, the Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, to supply fuel to the power plants that General Electric was building in northern India. I mean, there's a whole bunch of reasons that are I'm not defending, but these are the America as empire reasons. You know, there's the A, actually, I do defend Obama trying to clean up the mess that George Bush left. I'm not sure I'm far more sanguine about our occupying Afghanistan because of its strategic importance. But I would say that that's a big piece of it. Afghanistan and Iraq, you know, it's all about the oil. Make sense, Donald?
One question, too. Another question.
Yeah.
I don't know where I heard this from, but I remember somebody mentioning on one of the radio stations that Alan Grayson, one of the Democrats, signed a petition that they promised not to touch Social Security or Medicare, and if they do something, it was only to increase it.
Right. Bernie Sanders has basically started that, the Save Social Security Caucus or Strengthen Social Security Caucus in the Senate.
But I heard out of 200 Democrats, only 41 signed. Is there a way we can get a list of the ones that signed and the ones that didn't sign?
I would check, you know, if Alan Grayson actually did that, I would check his website. It's probably there.
Okay.
Say that again. Oh, congressmanwithguts.com, I guess, is the website. Donald, I got to run along. Thanks a lot for the call. Bruce in Port Angeles, Washington. Hey, Bruce, what's up?
Hi, Tom. It's good to talk to you, and I'm glad I got through. I agree very much with what you're saying about the drug testing, that it's basically harassment of those that don't have a voice, because if money is speech, they don't have the money, so they don't have the speech, and,
right.
And they're being harassed about that. But I don't think that the example that you use is a good one to win the day in the argument, especially with Republicans, saying that if somebody wants to have a life of sitting on a couch playing video games, doing nothing, and eating and taking drugs, that's a good example that's going to help win the day in the argument.
Yeah, but the fact of the matter is that there is always going to be a small number of people who are, you know, for whatever reason, who don't adapt well to society and who are going to do that. And if you consider those people, if you consider those people malefactors, if you consider them bad or whatever, that I don't have a problem with them existing. I mean, they're going to be here, you know. So you know, why should we?
I understand that.
I don't want them on the street. I don't want them sitting in front of my house. You know, I remember walking out of a hotel in India and having literally 30 kids follow me for blocks, begging for money. I don't want that in the United States.
I understand that, Tom. And I'm very progressive. I don't have an issue with that either. That's not what I'm saying.
Yeah.
If you're talking to people who are already on the other side of this argument,
yeah.
Then
no, you're right,
not
Bruce.
The people that are going to be the example to help you win the day in the
you're
argument.
Right. Being tolerant
I mean, the bottom line is, yeah, the bottom line is that, and you've already talked about this, that the cost of these testing programs are not cost effective in doing anything to change behavior.
Well, and poverty isn't driven by drug abuse. Drug abuse, in some cases, may be a symptom of poverty, but in fact, people on welfare are about one quarter as likely to use drugs as all the rest of us. So it's really, you know, if you could demonstrate that poverty was caused by drug abuse, then maybe it would make some sense. But there's no relationship between the two.
Exactly. And that money could be put into programs like WIC, which they just cut in this Cromney bus bill, and I realize that we're talking about Michigan State in particular, but still, there are plenty of other places that the money could be put to good use as opposed to drug testing for a non-problem.
I'm with you. And we should also bring back the CETA program that that Jimmy Carter had, which allowed nonprofits to basically hire people and the government paid their salaries. It was great. I was running a nonprofit during that time, and back in the late 70s, and it was it helped us tremendously. Anyhow, thanks so much for being with us today. We will be back again live tomorrow, so don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It does require you to participate and maybe pass along the fact that Chuck Todd told an accidental truth on the air. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.